The Historical Jesus by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. We can divide the various pictures moderns have of Jesus into two broad categories, basically religious views and allegedly historical views. Here we sketch these briefly, look at some recent developments, including the Jesus Seminar, and respond to their basic arguments. People have enormously diverse views about Jesus. Some are motivated by their religion, some motivated by their worldview. Others claim to be trying to grapple honestly with the historical data. Let's look first of all at the basically religious views. The biblical data point to a Jesus who is somehow fully God and fully human. Other religious views divide into two alternative categories. One, Jesus is only human, not God in any real sense. And Jesus is divine in some sense, but not in the biblical sense, not in the Trinitarian sense. Let's look first of all at Jesus only human. This is the view of atheism. Jesus was at best only human, according to atheists, since there isn't anything else, really. At least there are no gods, no spirits. Many atheists, in fact, have claimed that Jesus was fictional. This was, in fact, the standard communist view for many years. Islam believes that Jesus was a true prophet, born of a virgin who worked miracles, and that he will one day reign as Messiah, but that he is not God, since Allah is strictly one, and he has no son. Muslims generally believe that Jesus did not die on the cross, but he was snatched to heaven, and a substitute was put in his place. Old liberalism is the term we use for views arising out of Orthodox Christianity, but rejecting many features of the biblical account. According to old liberalism, the Gospels contain much legendary material, since miracles don't happen, the characteristic of old liberalism in seeking to make Christianity acceptable to moderns. They rejected miracles, as many of those who were influenced by the idea that somehow science could explain everything had moved into a materialistic view of reality. Miracles contain much legendary material, since miracles don't happen. God only worked providentially through Jesus. Old liberals are not atheists. But people misunderstood him, and he was deified by the early Gentile Christians. Jesus instead was some sort of ethical teacher who had more of God in him than others did. He died on the cross as an example, but his resurrection is only spiritual, not physical. Karl Barth became dissatisfied with old liberalism as he struggled with various pastoral problems and with thinking through the whole problem of the most advanced nations in the world fighting one another in World War I. And he came up with a view which is similar to old liberalism in regard to its view of the Gospels. That is, the Gospels contain much historical error and do not tell us, and God doesn't work in history by means of miracles. But Barth felt that the Jesus of history was not nearly so important as the Christ of faith. He made an attempt to rescue religious value while accepting what he called scientific history. This is kind of what lies at the basis of various versions of neo-orthodoxy, which more or less followed Barth. This view that Jesus is only human has had considerable influence on pop culture, and that's why I put up the picture here from the video of Jesus Christ Superstar, certainly one of the popular presentations of Jesus, which has been influenced by the Jesus only human approach. There are a number of other religious views, however, that see Jesus as divine in some sense, but not in the biblical sense. The Jehovah's Witnesses, for instance, believe that Jesus is a god, actually some sort of what we might call a reincarnation of the archangel Michael, by whom Jehovah God had created all things. However, Jesus is not the Almighty God and is not to be worshipped. Jesus was born of a virgin, worked miracles, died on the cross, his body dissolved in the tomb, but he will one day return and set up an earthly kingdom for his faithful witnesses. Mormonism has another take on Jesus. The Book of Mormon is actually fairly orthodox, more or less Trinitarian, and Jesus is viewed as virgin-born Messiah, miracle worker who rose from the dead. But Mormon's later scriptures indicate that men can become gods like Jesus did and like the Father did, and that Jesus was merely a man at the time he was on earth, but unusual in that he was the firstborn soul of his father and his spiritual mother in heaven. He was sent from heaven when Mary conceived, and since his ascension has become a god, his death only saves us from original sin. The New Age movement often sees Jesus as divine in some sense as well. The New Age movement is a very diverse group of views that are characterized by a mixture of Western attitudes and ideas, with elements especially reincarnation, borrowed from Hinduism and Buddhism. Generally, Jesus is viewed as one of the great, but usually not the greatest, ascended masters, who through spiritual effort and enlightenment have risen far above the level of most humans. Their offer, basically, is that you too can become a god by one or more techniques. The term Christ is typically used for a level of spiritual enlightenment and was not an office held uniquely by Jesus. I have a PowerPoint elsewhere on our IBRI website of the New Age Jesus that looks at two of these pictures of Jesus by New Age gurus, if you like. Well, we turn from basically religious views to what we might call allegedly historical views. In the past 200 years, we have seen numerous attempts to produce the, quote, real historical Jesus, who is allegedly quite different from the person pictured in the gospel. These attempts have regularly assumed that miracles do not occur, having been disproved by science, so that the gospels, filled as they are with miracles, cannot be reliable. Proponents of such views accept some of the gospel material and reject the rest. We here give some examples that are characteristic of various philosophical movements since just before 1800. Albert Schweitzer, in his Quest to Historical Jesus, discusses over 100 such liberal biographies of Christ. Herman Samuel Reimarus is illustrative of a deistic approach to Jesus. Deism, you may recall, sees God as the creator, as what we might think of as the watchmaker, but not one who intervenes in human affairs. Reimarus's book was published posthumously in fragments called the Wolfenbüttel Fragments, and two of these deal with Jesus concerning the story of the resurrection and the aims of Jesus and his disciples. Reimarus claims that Jesus thought himself to be a Jewish-type Messiah, that his intention was to bring the Jews back to God, to be a military commander to rescue them, but that Jesus made no attempt to found a new religion. He did do some psychosomatic healings, not miraculous ones, and tried to start a revolt against Rome, but failed and was put to death as a revolutionary. After Jesus' death, his disciples realized he had failed. Out of the habit of working by this time, they decided to start a new religion. They stole Jesus' body, claimed he had risen, and sent them out, claimed that Jesus had risen and sent them out to preach this new religion. They invented a new eschatology with a second coming. No, that's Herman Samuel Reimarus's Wolfenbüttel Fragments. Those were published in the late 1700s, 1774 to 1778. Publication of Reimarus's material created a sensation, destroyed his reputation. He was dead, however, at this point, and his family discouraged further publication. Yet it opened the way for later liberal reconstructions, which were mostly less drastic. It set a precedence for ignoring the epistles of Paul, Peter, and John, and of emphasizing Jesus' eschatological teaching, which Reimarus and most liberals do not like, and of claiming much material in the Gospels was the creation of the apostles and the later church, rather than going back to Jesus. We move on to rationalism, and here we take as our example Paulus and his work Leben Jesu. Unlike Ramaris, Heinrich Paulus wrote a sympathetic life of Christ. He saw Jesus as a great moral teacher of unusual insight and ability. Our main interest in Paulus's work is his rationalistic treatment of miracles as non-supernatural events misunderstood by the disciples as miracles. Paulus believed that Jesus really healed people by some unknown spiritual power which worked on the nervous system, something like ESP or hypnosis, that Jesus used natural medicine and diet, rather like today's holistic healers and health food people. Paulus realized that Jesus' nature miracles would be harder to explain, and he suggested that Jesus walking on water was really walking on the shore or walking on a sandbar, that Jesus used the little boy's loaves and fishes to shame the adults into sharing their hidden lunches, that Jesus' transfiguration was really the sunrise illuminating his hair and clothes from behind, and that the resurrections of Lazarus and others was Jesus recognizing that they were in a coma and waking them up. Jesus' own resurrection is viewed by Paulus as similar. Jesus did not die on the cross, but went into a coma. The cool tomb and aromatic spices revived him. An earthquake opened the tomb, and Jesus appeared to his disciples for a while, but later left them to die. His departure was misunderstood as an ascension as he walked up the hill into low clouds. The importance of Paulus's work was to spread such liberal views into, quote, Christian circles, claiming sympathy for Jesus, but still debunking miracles. Paulus did not lose his job or prestige over the book. His rationalizing approach to miracles, though soon ridiculed by liberals, is still used by them in some cases. We turn thirdly then to idealism and Strauss's Leben Jesu, 1835, so just 7 years after Paulus's Leben Jesu. Leben Jesu, by the way, German for life of Jesus. Idealism here we're thinking of as philosophical idealism, that is, ideas are the basic reality rather than matter. According to David Friedrich Strauss, the entire life of Jesus had been colored by mythological interpretation, not just his birth and resurrection, as some had earlier suggested. Myth is here defined as timeless religious truth clothed in historical form, often by using legendary materials. Thus, the religious ideas expressed in the events of Jesus' life are true, but the events did not really happen. For example, the deity of Christ is not a historical truth, but a myth expressing, quote, the highest idea ever conceived by man, the unity of Godhood and manhood, unquote. That is, we are all divine in some sense. In Leben Jesu, Strauss attacks both the orthodox and rationalistic ideas of Jesus, especially mocking Paulus' explanation for the miracles. But he presents few positive explanations of his own for the historical events, probably because he was not greatly concerned with what happened. Strauss' book met with strong reaction in his day because it was both anti-Christian and anti-rationalistic. It laid the groundwork, however, for Bultmann a century later and the demythologizing school in the 20th century. Strauss posed three problem areas which have continued to dominate liberal studies on Jesus to this day. These problems are miracle versus myth. Strauss virtually ended the liberal acceptance of miracles in the gospel accounts as historical. Only the healing accounts are accepted by some liberals today who said Jesus did some psychosomatic healing, as faith healers still do. The second problem area was the Jesus of history versus the Christ of faith. Strauss separated historical truth from religious value, favoring a Christ of faith approach. And then the problem of John, Gospel of John versus the Synoptics, Strauss established a widespread rejection of John by attacking its reliability more effectively than Reimarus had done earlier. As our fourth example, we move on to the middle of the 1800s. Renan's La Vie de Jesus, 1863, an example of Romanticism. Romanticism was a reaction against rationalism's emphasis on reason and logic. Emotions and intuitions give insight which you cannot obtain through reason, getting a little bit in Romanticism, like the postmodern reaction here to modernism. Differences, of course, a century apart. As Ernst Renan sees it, the Gospels' picture of Jesus doesn't make sense. after you remove the miraculous. So he sorts the materials into three different phases in Jesus' life. The phase in which Jesus sees himself as an ethical teacher, the phase in which he sees himself as a revolutionary, and the phase in which Jesus sees himself as a martyr. Renan claimed that all three phases were historical, but they got mixed together chronologically in the Gospel accounts. Each facet was a distinct period in his life. First of all, ethical teacher, Jesus begins as an optimistic, pleasant ethical teacher who learned to preach from John the Baptist, returns to Galilee as a gentle teacher of love, attracts a devoted following of young men and women, plus large crowds of charmed Galileans. He does no miracles except some psychosomatic healings. Secondly, when Jesus goes to Jerusalem, he finds the rabbis will not accept him. As a result, he becomes a revolutionary and campaigns to get rid of them. He begins doing faked miracles to attract a larger following. Thirdly, third phase, soon Jesus realizes that his movement does not have enough popular support to beat the rabbis, and that he cannot continue to stage miracles indefinitely without being discovered. He decides to throw off all earthly ambitions and become a martyr. Before his death, he starts a religious movement so that his teachings will be preserved. He institutes the simple ceremonies of baptism and the Lord's Supper to give unity to the group, and chooses its leaders, the apostles. He allows himself to be caught and dies on the cross. According to Renan, his strategy worked out better than Jesus expected, as Mary Magdalene has a hallucination that Jesus is alive. Renan's work is important in spreading liberal reconstructions of Jesus' life to the popular educated classes, and particularly into Catholicism. Renan opened the way to the idea that reliability can be judged by aesthetics. God can't be that way because I don't like it. His idea that the chronological framework of the Gospels is untrustworthy will be picked up later with Bultmann and form criticism. We move on to the beginning of the 20th century with Wilhelm Vrede and his Messianic Secret, published in 1901. Skeptics are doubters to a greater degree than the positions above, feeling it's impossible to reconstruct the life of Jesus. Vrede reacts against reconstructions like those sketched above, arguing that much in these pictures is obtained by reading between the lines and ignoring what Jesus has to say about the second coming, judgment, hell, and such. Vrede does not attempt a full life of Christ, but tries to solve a single problem. Why, if Jesus claimed to be the Messiah, did he keep telling people to keep this a secret? Vrede's answer is that Mark invented the Messianic secret because Jesus never claimed to be the Messiah, but Mark and his circle thought that Jesus actually was. Vrede comes to believe that Mark's whole narrative framework is unreliable, so that only some of the individual stories and sayings in his gospel really happened. At this point, in our narrative of liberal lives of Jesus, notice that the liberals have now thrown out all the Gospels. John is late, Matthew and Luke build on Mark, and Mark is unreliable. This deep skepticism toward the Gospel accounts led to the application of form criticism to the life of Christ by Rudolf Bultmann and others beginning about 1920, and thereafter brought a stop to the writing of liberal lives of Christ, at least on a scholarly level, until about 1950. Quests for the historical of Jesus were resumed in the 1950s, the so-called second quest, by liberals who were dissatisfied with a particular form of extreme skepticism advocated by Bultmann. We are now generally felt to be in a phase called the third quest, or even later. That brings us to the present situation, a situation of considerable diversity. Renan's observation is correct. Once the miracles are excluded from Jesus' ministry, his person and life do not make sense, and a variety of possibilities can be imagined. Modern theories are often simply various combinations of previously noted possibilities. We give a fair sketch of some of the views advocated since World War II. The post-Bultmannians and paradox. Post-Bultmannian is a term for former students of Bultmann, especially Günter Bornkamm, Hans Conzelmann, Klaus Fuchs, Ernst Casemann, and James M. Robinson. Bornkamm is the only one who wrote A Life of Christ, Jesus of Nazareth, published in 1960. The others wrote encyclopedia and journal articles. All are anti-supernatural, but feel Bultmann went too far in his skepticism. They have more interest in history than he did, and feel that the New Testament material gives us at least the atmosphere of what Jesus thought about Jesus, what people thought about Jesus. Their historical methodology is very skeptical. Ignore the Gospel of John. Use the synoptics. Pick out the authentic incidents and sayings of Jesus by using the method of dissonance. What's the method of dissonance? Method of dissonance is this. Jesus himself was a Jew, and his followers were Christian. Thus, any feature of Jesus reporting teachings which look Jewish might go back to the Jews, not to Jesus himself. Any material which looks Christian may go back to the early Christians, not to Jesus. Only those teachings which are incompatible with both Judaism and Christianity probably goes back to Jesus. And we examine this material to get Jesus' self-understanding. Well, we might point out that dissonance has problems as a methodology. If we use the same sort of material on Martin Luther, we would reject any material where he sounds either Catholic or Lutheran. However, these Bultmannians, post-Bultmannians, have deduced some interesting results which do not fit the liberal models well. Casaubon, Bornkamm, Fuchs, etc., think about Jesus' view of himself. Casaubon sees a very distinct atmosphere present in the New Testament. Jesus thought of himself as divinely and uniquely inspired, and that he was greater than a prophet. Jesus made messianic claims, according to Casaubon. Bornkamm and Fuchs wouldn't go along with all this, but they believed that Jesus claimed he could forgive sins. In regard to Jesus' teachings, Casaubon sees Jesus' main message that God has come to give men what they don't deserve and to set them free from bondage. Consulman sees Jesus speaking of a future kingdom, which in some sense is confronting us right now. This point, by the way, future kingdom confronting us right now, is regularly lost in old liberalism, which typically sets these two elements in contradiction. Regarding Jesus' conduct, Bornkamm and Fuchs point out that Jesus' actions show that he submitted to God, yet he claims a unique authority seen in the cleansing of the temple. He also showed great graciousness to outcasts. Contrast Jesus' attitude with the Pharisees' attitude. These results seem rather minimal, and yet they're striking. They suggest that Jesus is much more than liberals have granted, and that they should reconsider their skepticism. Another of the diverse elements that we see in the present situation shows up in Hugh Schoenfield's popular book, The Passover Plot, published in 1966. Hugh Schoenfield was a liberal British Jew who worked on the International Dead Sea Scroll Committee. Apparently accepted the claims of Jesus at one point in his career, but later gave it up. He's quite familiar with evangelical interpretations of Old Testament prophecy. According to Schoenfield, Jesus' ministry is an elaborate plot to fulfill the Old Testament prophecies regarding the Messiah, especially his own death and resurrection. Jesus, convinced that he is the Messiah, gathers disciples, but avoids claiming publicly to be the Messiah for his own safety. Notice an explanation of Freda's messianic secret here. Eventually, however, Jesus is rejected in Galilee and realizes that he must, quote, die, unquote, and rise again in order to fulfill Old Testament prophecies such as Psalm 22. Jesus decides to fake his death rather than trust God for a resurrection. He constructs a plot using several assistants who are only in on parts of the plot. Lazarus' death and resurrection is faked to build tension with the authority. The colt is arranged for the triumphal entry, forcing the Jewish authorities to take action to avoid a revolt. Jesus controls the timing of his arrest so that he will be crucified for only a few hours. With the code words, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," shouted from the cross, an assistant drugs him with a sponge, and Jesus goes into a coma. The plot, almost perfect, is ruined by the spear thrust from the Roman soldier. Jesus is taken down by Joseph Arimathea and an unnamed conspirator we'll call Mr. X. That night, he's removed from the tomb, taken to another place, and revived. He gives Mr. X a message to carry to his disciples. Tell them to meet me in Galilee. But then Jesus dies after Mr. X leaves to deliver the message. Mr. X tries to tell the women at the tomb, but they think he's an angel. He tries to tell some disciples on the road to Emmaus, but they mistake him for Jesus. The confusion continues. Any appearances where Jesus was not immediately recognized are treated as those of Mr. X. The clear and solid appearances of Jesus are viewed as stories made up by the later church. Schoenfield's story reflects the influence of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, with more emphasis on messianic expectation at Jesus' time, and renewed appreciation for the Gospel of John as a source. It's peculiar in its daring treatment of Old Testament prophecies. It's a classic example of a plot theory. Brief aside on plot theories. A plot theory claims that some set of historical events can be better explained, not by the stated or surface motivations, but by an unstated, hidden, secret plot. The claim that Kennedy was killed by the CIA, or Lincoln by the radical Republicans, are examples of plot theories. Plots clearly occur in human history, but plot theories face serious methodological problems. These are, the better the plot, the more hidden it was and is, and therefore the less useful our data is. The perfect plot doesn't fit the data at all. Secondly, therefore it's possible to construct far more plots than could actually happen, so that the chance of any one plot being true is very small. Third, it's impossible to prove a plot theory right or wrong before the last judgment, but very dangerous to hang one's worldview on a particular plot theory. We move on to a third picture of the diversity of the present situation, that of John Marco Allegro in his book The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, published in 1970. John Marco Allegro was a professor at the University of Manchester, England, and another British representative on the International Dead Sea Scroll Team. Gives you rather a bad impression of the International Dead Sea Scroll Team. This book ruined his academic reputation. Allegro has a superplot theory, more radical than Bultmann or Schoenfield. In his view, Jesus never existed. Christianity never existed. Judaism never existed in the first century. Their books and teachings are all expressions of code words used to describe a super-secret mushroom and fertility cult. Sex and drug cult, we might say. Judaism and Christianity do not appear to be such now, because the secrets were lost under persecution, and the front organizations continued and developed on their own. Allegro tries to prove this by using etymology, that the Old Testament and New Testament are filled with secret codes relating to hallucinogenic mushrooms and sexual orgies. He uses Latin, Greek, Arabic, Persian, Syriac, Hebrew, Aramaic, Sanskrit, Ugaritic, Akkadian, and Sumerian, enough to snow all but the best linguists. We move on to Morton Smith, The Secret Gospel, 1973, and Jesus the Magician, 1978. Morton Smith was a professor of ancient history at Columbia University, studied in Israel 1941-45, received a PhD from the University of from Hebrew University and a THD from Harvard. Smith claims he discovered in 1958 at the Mar Sava Greek Orthodox Monastery in the wilderness of Israel a letter from Clement of Alexandria, flourished about 200 AD, copied into the back of a Greek book published in the 1700s. The book with letter, if it ever existed, has disappeared. For the text of the letter, see pages 14 through 17 of the Secret Gospel. The letter answers some charges made by a Gnostic group called the Carpocratians, who had a different version of the Gospel of Mark, included lewd material used to justify their sexual immorality. Clement says he has a secret, longer version of Mark, not including the lewd material, which the Carpocratians stole, then corrupted for the libertine group. Smith sides with the Carpocratians in claiming Jesus was really a libertine, a Gnostic, a magician, and that this explains his miracles, his personal claims to deity, secrecy, and statements about the law. Such as men are not responsible to the law in any way. This is not a clumsy fraud. Clement was interested in these topics. The letter resembles Clement's style. If it is a forgery, the writer knew at least as much as Smith. And in fact, there's pretty good evidence now that Smith himself is the forger. There's been a recent interesting parallel with a clever crook in Mormon circles in recent years as well. You can scout that out on the internet sometime if you'd like. We turn last to the Jesus Seminar as an example of the diversity in the present situation. The Jesus Seminar is a group of radical New Testament researchers who've been meeting for 20 years or so to produce a scholarly presentation of Jesus that will, they think, blow traditional Christianity out of the water. They've been given extensive media publicity every time they meet, about every 6 months, and in 1993 presented their first book-length production, Robert Funk, Roy Hoover, and the Jesus Seminar, The Five Gospels, The Search for the Authentic Words of Jesus. Since then, they have done another work on the authentic acts of Jesus. I won't say much more about them, except that they get together and assign a topic to discuss for each of their meetings, and then get together and vote on whether they think that Jesus really did that or not, with the a clever suggestion that they have four colored marbles that you put in a basket for voting: red if you think Jesus really said or did this, pink if you think that he might have, but it's quite uncertain, gray if you think, well, it's possible, but it's not really likely he did it, and black if you're pretty sure he did not do it. Well, that's a very fast tour of the Jesus Seminar. I might mention several works that are helpful responses to the Jesus Seminar. Craig Blomberg's work, The Historical Reliability of the Gospels. Greg Boyd's book, Cynic Sage or Son of God. William Lane Craig's book, Reasonable Faith. Josh McDowell and Michael, and Bill Wilson, that is, He Walked Among Us. And Craig Evans, Fabricating Jesus. Let's see if we can summarize where we've gotten to on our tour of these liberal lives of Jesus, these allegedly historical pictures of Jesus. Their guiding principle is the rejection of miracle. As a result, over the century or so that this has been going on, two centuries now that this has been going on, a progressive skepticism towards the biblical materials. But as a result of this, Jesus becomes an enigma. He doesn't make sense. If Jesus never existed, where did all this data come from? If Jesus were a fraud, where does the moral teaching that we see him giving come from? If Jesus is a gentle teacher, why the opposition that he aroused? How do we reconcile Jesus' moral teaching with his claims? In fact, if Jesus is not supernatural, Jesus does not make sense. And since they have in principle rejected the supernatural, Jesus does not make sense to the liberals. Well, we should think a little bit then about the question, are their arguments against miracle valid? Well, one form of their argument, which is not seen actually stated very frequently, is the claim that miracle is logically contradictory. And the form this argument takes basically is that miracle is a violation of natural law, that to violate natural law is either to commit sin or to commit a logical fallacy or to blunder aesthetically. And since God cannot commit a sin, commit logical fallacies or blunder aesthetically, therefore God cannot do miracles. Our question is miracle really a contradictory argument? Now note that this argument will not work against satanic miracles, since he can certainly sin, commit logical fallacies, and may even blunder aesthetically. But although the logical argument, logical structure of this argument is sound, we have to examine the content of the propositions. Is miracle necessarily a violation of natural law? If I am if I lift up a chair, is that a violation of the law of gravity? Well, it depends on your definition of violation. Since miracle is a violation of natural law has been used frequently by Christians, common definition of miracle, we should perhaps not fault this claim too heavily, although I think Christians have been mistaken in that particular definition. There is ambiguity in the term law. Sin implies a moral law, fallacy implies a logical law, blunder implies an aesthetic law. But are we justified in mixing moral precepts with physical constraints? Does breaking a physical law necessarily imply moral sin has occurred? Also, are these the only possibilities for categorizing a violation of natural law? Perhaps there's another physical law, and we should not limit God to these three. So, this statement is an incomplete statement treating on ambiguity of law. Even if we grant that God cannot violate natural laws, and that somehow natural law is a sin or a logical blunder or a aesthetic blunder. Is it clear that the Bible, it is clear that the Bible contains moral laws which are intended only for humans Hence, God can violate them. That is, God can command us to worship Him because of who He is, but we should not command people to worship us. Thus, the Bible has a precedent for person-dependent laws. What is a violation for us may not be for God, as that law does not apply to Him. It's dangerous to limit or judge God by our standards. Upshot is that deductive argument is not conclusive, especially as miracles are connected with God as one of His attributes. Since we cannot safely explore the supernatural on our own, arguing with revelation about it just leaves us in the dark. Sometimes people will argue that the biblical picture of God is inferior because it pictures God as needing to tinker with His universe. If God were really great, He would have made the natural laws better so that He would not need to interfere with them. However, this assumes that God desired to create a universe that was fully automatic. Perhaps He desired to create a universe which allowed for self-expression. Contrast a clock, something automatic, which we think rather gauche for the maker to be tinkering with it all the time, with a guitar, which is designed for input. What about the inductive arguments? Well, David Hume is probably the most influential one with inductive arguments. He basically, in his argument, shifts the definition of a miracle from rare to impossible. And when someone tells us of an event, he says, we tend to accept the report or be skeptical of it in proportion to the degree that it's unusual. By definition, he says, a miracle is a very rare and unusual event, and our uniform experience dictates against the miraculous. Thus, we should be very skeptical about any reports of miracles. The means by which we know something, he says, is our experience in the world. Since miracles go against us and upset our uniform experience, we tend to explain them by some naturalistic means, unless that explanation would itself be more unusual than accepting a miracle. Hume at this point shifts his argument to a program. Thus, when a miracle is reported, we should reject it, unless any naturalistic explanation would be even more unusual. Well, that's Hume. We have to admit that our skepticism does increase as one tells us that he met a person yesterday, as this person shifts from being some friend that we know to President Clinton, to Queen Elizabeth, to Martin Luther, to Jesus, etc. His second statement that miracles are rare, very rare events, is correct, and we should tend to be skeptical of reports of them. But in the middle of that statement, he says something that is incorrect. Hume has shifted his definition of miracle from a rare event to an impossible event. His conclusion is thus the result of a circular argument. Whose uniform experience is Hume considering when he says the uniform experience of humans is against miracles? Over what time period? How many individuals is he including? To try to use the uniform experience of all humanity would not work, as some people report that they've seen miracles. It's true even in modern times. We have non-sympathetic reports of occult miracles in the literature, and of the events at Fatima, of spontaneous human combustion, etc. A more general problem with Hume's argument is that if we assume miracles do occur, this methodology tells us to explain them away anyhow. Thus, the argument must be inadequate since it does not include a method that tests their possible occurrence. Adolf Harnack represents another form of inductive argument against miracle. We can see that in What is Christianity, pages 24 and 25 in the Harper Torch Book edition. And basically, Harnack says we do not need to accept miracles because they are based on primitive ignorance. In New Testament times, he says miracles were thought to be commonplace, and that New Testament people did not know enough science to recognize a miracle when they saw one. Well, those are rather weak sorts of things. Problem. New Testament times, miracles were thought to be commonplace. The reaction of people in the New Testament accounts showed that they did not expect miraculous interventions, that they were not ho-hum events. New Testament people always marvel when miracles occur and have trouble drawing simple lessons from them. This implies they did not view them as common or even as expected. We must be careful when we decide what can and cannot occur on the basis of our preconceptions. For instance, in the late 18th century, scientists in France and America, including Thomas Jefferson, refused to believe that stones fell from the sky, because only peasants and priests reported seeing them. This sky does not contain rocks principle that they were operating on proved to be inaccurate. The other claim, that New Testament people did not know enough science to recognize a miracle when they saw one, appeals to our pride in high technology. Much of our advanced technology does look miraculous to primitives, radio, telephone, computer, etc. However, can we now explain away Jesus' miracles by means of high technology? His walking on water, his raising dead? New Testament people knew which diseases did not heal suddenly. People today can still not explain these miracles with technology. It is impressive that Jesus did those types of miracles, which still stump us in the 21st century. Wolfman assumes that the universe cannot be penetrated by God, etc. Well, I think that's rather foolish, again, because we don't know enough about the universe to know whether it can or cannot be penetrated. In fact, recent scientific discoveries suggest that we're looking at some kind of a mind behind the universe. There are examples of things in the history of biology that suggest maybe the universe is being penetrated by a designer of some sort. More of that in my PowerPoint talks on intelligent design and such. Well, many would object, oh, if you accept miracle, what's that going to do to science and to history? Well, what can we say about that? What does acceptance of the miraculous do to history and science in general? Many historians and scientists are, in fact, scared of miracle because they think then the whole bottom drops out of their work. My job, they might say, is to explain reality, and this would introduce a whole new realm. Scientific historians often feel there should be no miraculous interventions needed to explain history. Well, adding miracles does add a new dimension to reality for many people. History has thus been explained without miracles, but we don't know if these explanations are true since we can't check them. What does miracle do to science and history? Well, it makes an enormous difference in ultimate explanation. If there's a God who intervenes, then history will be affected on a large scale. God and other supernatural beings introduce the possibility of new purposes and goals. It may or may not make a big difference on a local scale. What difference it makes on a small scale depends on the actual frequency of miracles at that time and place. There may be points in history when miracles were happening, but they were not important historically. Orthodox Christians, including myself, believe that regeneration, causing people to be born again, is miraculous and does affect history. And there may be points in history where miracles are extremely important for understanding the events. What does miracle do to science and history? It does add another variable to explanations, another variable for use in constructing models, but doesn't follow that this variable must be invoked at every gap any more than in any other mode of explanation. There already are plenty of difficult to assess variables in understanding history, individual personalities, backgrounds, motivations, economics, etc. We don't have to invoke a miracle whenever an event occurs we cannot explain. From the biblical perspective, miracle is not irrational, because it's the action of a rational being. And in God's case, it's accompanied by revelation. Some people object that miracles add an irrational element to history, but by this they mean it adds an element they cannot predict what it will do. This destroys the historian's dream of being able to predict the future. Christian realizes that something irrational is not being added. Another mind is involved, but God's mind is logical and rational. Through revelation, God explains what he's doing in his miracles before and after the event. Satan may or may not tell what he is doing, and he's not trustworthy in any case. Sin and sinful minds are irrational, but God is not. And we already got sin and sinful minds making plenty of irrational in human history. Thus, satanic miracles may be irrational, but in dealing with the motivations of sinful humans, we already have plenty of irrational history. In fact, the miraculous itself is a revelation of the unseen supernatural person, God, just as human activity is a revelation of the unseen inner man. In any case, miracle, what does it do to science and history, solves a lot of problems in biblical history and in natural prehistory. We do more with this in other PowerPoint things, so we're not going to do anything more with it here. What are we to make of these liberal reconstructions of Jesus? Well, C.S. Lewis gives us a hint in his fictional work, The Screwtape Letters. He tells us that, indeed, these liberal reconstructions are Satan's work. That in the Screwtape Letters, the Macmillan edition, page 116 to 118, hardback edition, and in the paperback edition, 105 to 109, basically, Screwtape is describing how to keep people distracted from the real Jesus. And he basically says, this is chapter 23 in the Screwtape Letters, which Cross is a good reference, Cross edition. he says, the way to keep people distracted from the real Jesus is to have them search for the historical Jesus and write a new life of Jesus every few years. Such work is called brilliant in literary circles, but it's based on a type of guesswork that would be ruinous in business, in betting on horses, or anything of that sort. This distraction from the real Jesus is a modern form of idolatry, since they make up their own Jesus. Why does God permit something like this? Well, in Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 5, we have a discussion of why the Lord allows false prophets to arise. And that would be parallel to what we see going on here, if you like. And the answer that passage gives is that allowing this to happen is a test for people to see whether they love the God who exists in comparison with the gods of human invention, who often look more attractive or more tolerant of their sin. The world and its history is a testing ground to demonstrate that humans are as bad as God says they are, and that only his mercy can save us. A nice discussion of the reality of miracles from an evangelical perspective is given in Guyvet and Hagermass's book, the editors, In Defense of Miracles, A Comprehensive Case for God's Action in History. Well, that's the end of our rather quick tour here. But it's not the end of attempts to construct other Jesuses. We see in the recent Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, and other materials of this sort. We can expect more of this until Jesus comes again. We do not need to be afraid of this kind of material. We just need to pay attention to what extent they are fantasizing and to what extent they are seriously dealing with the historical evidence, to what extent they are smuggling in the idea that miracles can occur. Obviously, no-brainer, if miracles can occur, then the Gospels can't be reliable. And Jesus can't be what he claims he is. But that remains to be proved. And unless one makes an assumption in that direction that the gospel, that miracles can't occur, the Gospels indeed look very, very reliable. Craig Blomberg, in his book I mentioned earlier, The Historical Reliability of the Gospels, deals with this very nicely indeed. So we should not expect that we won't see any more of this. We will see plenty of this until Jesus comes again. May you be on your guard and dealing fairly with the evidence.